Well met, friends. I'm Jude Bays.
And I'm Steph Midlock.
Welcome to Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the happy hierarchies of Tolkien's Legendarium.
We just wanted to take a minute to acknowledge what's happening in the world right now. Currently, we're broadcasting to you from lockdown this month as the coronavirus is sweeping all of us and all of our families and friends. And we just wanted to take a moment from us at Atherbeth to acknowledge this crappy moment in history and just to wish you all health and safety during this challenging time.
Yep. Steph? Do we have any corrections in the calls to sack this episode?
Yes, we do. Of course, it's from me, shocking nobody. So I think last episode, I was talking about Numenor or something, and we were talking about how, you know, the dudes, the Numenoreans, those dudes were not supposed to go west. And I think I said something like the elves told them, like, don't go west or we'll be mad at you. But clearly that's not a thing. That would have been the Valar, not the elves. So when I was listening back to that episode, I thought, well, that was dumb. But anyway, just a silly slip. But don't worry, I know.
The elves probably conveyed the message, so that's not an entirely ununderstandable.
Yeah, the elves probably sent them a really nice muffin basket being like, Valar said, don't come. So you better not. And also enjoy these blueberry mini muffins.
Yeah, there you go.
Cool. That's all I got.
Cool.
So what are we doing this month, Jude?
Well, this month we're doing something a little bit different. Historically, we have talked about specific works, specific essays or things like that. The only time we've done something like this is when we talked about Elven Souls. This episode, we're going to be talking about Elven kingship, and specifically the tendency of elves to adhere to a hierarchy. This was an essay that I never ended up finishing for a Mythgard class that I just think is an idea that's really interesting. And we'll get into it. Yeah. So let's just get into it.
That sounds great. I can't wait to learn more about that. I think we should do like a whole lecture series on like elves and their bullshit, Jude's musings on.
I mean, that's kind of why I started this podcast, so I could make people listen to my bullshit about elves. So
excellent. I'm so excited.
Yeah. Well, we've got many elven paths to tread, so let's begin. So I'm going to start, because this comes from an essay, I have a thesis statement.
Oh, shit. I love a good thesis statement. Wrap it
so
up for
I'm
us.
So I'm going to hit you with my thesis statement right at the top.
Woohoo!
And then I'll throw some fucking supporting evidence at you. We're going to do this AP English style.
All right. I love it. Organization.
So the basic gist here of what I'm getting at is that elves demonstrate a natural adherence to hierarchy that is absent in men. That's capital M, men, as in Tolkien's men. And it is most obvious in the preponderance of and unusually standard goodness of their kings. My assertion is that this is owed to the generally unfallen nature of the elves, and that this is supported by the fact that the vast majority of instances where we see elven kings being bad or elven hierarchies being questioned involves individuals who demonstrate what we might call Melkorish corruption. This is supported by the Numenorean kings, who are men that are uplifted, so to speak, by an infusion of elven blood. And as they are corrupted over time and descend into Melkorish behavior, you see a mirror of that behavior. So we're going to take a look at the elves and sort of establish their tendency towards hierarchy, and then take a look at some of their kings and how they deviate from that hierarchy, and then take a look at the Numenorean kings.
Awesome. That sounds great.
Yeah. Should be fun.
Yeah.
So let's start by looking at some examples of the elven tendency towards hierarchy. And we're going to start way at the beginning with a tale that is, as a caveat, is maybe true?
Mm.
Question mark.
What does that mean?
The actual historicalness of this account. This is a piece called the Cuivianna. Cuiviennarn. Oh, this word is weird. It's hard. Cuiviennarn.
Ooh. Okay.
It is a. The frame for this piece is that it is a legend that the elves tell that is used to teach their children how to count, but is also supposedly used to tell the legend of how they first awoke.
This is like Elven Sesame Street. Is that what you're...
Yeah, it's a it's an elven parable that recounts their origins, but is also used to teach children how to count.
Okay, cool.
It tells the story of the three founders of the elven groups of what eventually would become the Vanyar, the Noldor, and the Teleri, Imin, Tata, and Enel. And their names became the basis for elven numbers, 1, 2, and 3. And this is how the sort of the basis of their counting system being based on the number of elves, the first three elf fathers, and the number of elves that they first awoke.
Whoa, that's really cool.
This is where their base 12 counting system comes from.
Okay.
And so on and so forth. What's interesting about this story, so the Cuiviennarn is interesting. So I'm going to kind of summarize it for you.
Sure.
So the three elven fathers wake up. And the first thing they see is basically each other, more or less. They wake up first. And then they wake up 1, 2, 3. Imin, Tata, Enel. And then the first sight they see is the stars.
Right.
And then they see their spouses.
Who are still asleep?
Yeah.
Okay.
Iminye, Tatie, and Enelie. They begin thinking of words, because that's what elves do. They think of words.
Hmm.
They come together, and they begin walking through the dells of Cuivienen. And they go walking around the lake, and the first group they come to is a group of 12 sleeping elves. It's pairs, 6 men and 6 women.
Okay.
And Imin claims the right to take these as his companions. And he does. And they continue to walk. And they find another group of, 18? Yeah, 18. And they continue walking. And those become the companions of Tata.
Okay.
And then they walk a little bit further. And then they come to a group of 24. And that becomes those become the companions of Enel. And these become the founders of the elven families of the Vanyar, the Noldor, and the Teleri.
Oh, so the Vanyar was much smaller than, like, the Teleri.
And historically, the Vanyar have always been smaller than the Noldor and the Teleri, and the Teleri have always been much more populous than the other two.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, we're going to make Red Rover teams, so they're, like, choosing their sides. I gotcha.
Yeah.
Cool.
So what's interesting to me about this is... This tale, there's two ways to look at this. First, let's look at it like a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Like let's say that it's not true. And it's a story that they tell. But the story that this records, the myth that this records, that they tell their children, is one in which their society, which is demonstrably organized into these three categories. The origin of their society is one in which their three founders wake up, they're immediately paired And then they are immediately, the first thing those pairs do is go looking for companions to form groups. And those groups are immediately sorted into groups.
Yeah, interesting.
They establish the hierarchy of their society within like a half hour.
Yeah, totally.
And that hierarchy remains tens of thousands of years later. So even if it's not true, even if this is a myth that they tell, which is of dubious, which is probably not the case, knowing that the tale of the queen, there are people who were alive who were probably there.
Mm-hmm.
There are elves alive that were probably at Quivienen.
Wow. You know, there's like one really, really, really ancient elf who's like, damn, if I just had not hit that snooze button, I would have been the first one to wake up. I would have been the king of all the friggin' Teleri. So friggin' goddamn it.
What's interesting about this is that Tata is not Finwë.
Okay.
So the father of the second group is not the same as Finwë, the king of the Noldor.
And really, it should be Finwë, right?
You would think so, right?
Hmm.
But it's not, which I always found interesting, and there's no explanation for that.
Or it's like, did he go by another name, or... Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Hmm, that's kind of cool.
Oh, that's right, I forgot. There's a second... They do this counting thing a second time around. I forgot that part. But they go through and they find a second batch of elves. So they each find another group of elves.
Oh, awesome.
But the gist is the same. You get the gist of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you take it as literal, it's even more reinforcing of this idea of elves falling naturally into these hierarchies, because these people wake up and they, okay, I'm an Imin now. I'm part of Tata's people. They immediately align into these groupings. Like, it's just what they do. And it's not like there's... And it's what they do to the point that the only indication we have of any unwillingness to follow this is when Orme shows up.
Oh, yeah.
And tells them to come with them to Valinor. And what's interesting about that is... that's a deviation from the plan. Morgoth has intervened and cast fear into them, and the Valar are interfering with their original plan. They're not supposed to be taken out of Middle-earth and taken to Valinor.
Interesting. But because Melkor started meddling, they felt like they had to do
they
that.
They had to interfere.
Sure.
So their unwillingness, those who refused the call... that's the first time you see some that are unwilling, that break away, that refuse. Up until that point, there's no indication that any of these elves are not adhering to this hierarchy.
That's interesting. And do you think that's like a religious thing, like from Tolkien's religious side? Because I mean, blind faith, like following with no question, right?
I don't think it's blind faith. What I think it is, and this is a real core piece of my thesis, I think the elves represent an unfallen people. They don't blindly follow this hierarchy. It's that for them, the hierarchy is the correct and proper place for them, and because they're unfallen, it's their rightful place. It's not that they're blindly following it. It's that the world has a proper place for them, and because they are not a fallen people, they fit into the world properly. And when you see Morgoth when the marring touches them, they no longer fit into the world. That's when they begin to stray out of that proper place.
That's really interesting. That's cool.
So, and this is what we're gonna illustrate as we go through some more of these examples here. As we talk about some of these kings, you'll see examples of these people who are exemplars of this hierarchy who, once they become touched by this marring, they don't follow this hierarchy. They break away, or they break the hierarchy because they're corrupted by Morgoth.
Okay.
Because they're marred.
There are some real baddies coming up, and that I'm very excited.
Yeah, there's a lot of trash coming up here.
Yay! So. Well, I'll buy it. I'll definitely buy it. I like it. It makes a lot of sense to me based on what we know. So can I ask you, where is this piece, the Kuri Vienyarna, where is that found?
That is found in War of the Jewels.
Okay.
In a really entertaining essay called Quendi and Eldar, which is this one of my favorites, is this very long piece that goes into a lot of the weird lifestyle habits of the elves and has some very entertaining stuff about elves in it.
What? Oh, we need to do that. Oh, I want to know everything.
We've talked about Quendi and Eldar before a little bit, and you've rolled your eyes at some of the horse hockey that comes out of that piece. So.
Oh, that sounds fun. Okay, promise me we'll get back there someday.
Yeah.
Yay. We
will. All right. So for our example, we're going to follow the line of Finwë, because there's not much we can do with the line of the Vanyar kings, and the Teleri kings is a little bit messy, and there's not a whole lot of examples. But Finwë, who Billy, plenty to work with there. There's a quote I want to read that is very that I think is really good and is, I think, instructive. So we're going to start with this.
Okay.
In those unhappy things which later came to pass, and in which Feanor was the leader, many saw the effect of this breach within the house of Finwë, judging that if Finwë had endured his loss and been content with the fathering of his mighty son, the courses of Feanor would have been otherwise, and great evil might have been prevented. For the sorrow and the strife in the house of Finwë is graven in the memory of the Noldor and Elves. But the children of Indis were great and glorious, and their children also. And if they had not lived, the history of the Eldar would have been diminished. That's from The Silmarillion, Chapter 6 of Feanor and the Unchaining of Melkor.
Are you okay if I... Are you going to... Can I remind everybody what they're talking about, or are you going to do that?
I'm about to do that.
Yeah. All right, so drop a beat on us. Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about here is Feanor, Finwë has remarried. Finwë remarries and has a second set of kids after his first wife, Muriel, dies. And this line is talking about all the things that happened as a consequence of that one action.
Right. And Feanor was the son from the first marriage, and he was kind of pissed at the second marriage and the second set of sons, right?
Yeah.
And that's where
a tremendous amount of things can be traced back to this one action.
Okay.
What's interesting to me about this quote is this line, is that it does highlight that this one thing can be traced back to this one event. And what's more interesting to me is that death, Muriel's death, is considered the first marring of Valinor. It's the first time that the marring had touched Valinor. And from that first marring, what happens? Muriel dies.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens.
Well, I mean, whatever. I mean, again, Feanor did not have to react like such an ass face to everything.
Well, but look at
I get you.
It's a chain of events.
Yeah.
Muriel dies. Finwë is a horn dog. And
no, he's not a horn dog. He just wants to get remarried. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, well, except that it is unheard of in the history of elves.
Okay.
And it is contrary to how elves have ever functioned.
Yeah, but
elves
are
designed to have one spouse.
That's dumb. What are you, a duck?
I 100% agree with you. But the point I'm making is the marring enters Valinor.
Okay.
And disrupts his life. And so he tries to repair it, but it's marred now.
Gotcha.
And the repercussions are rippling through here.
Can you remind me how she died?
Giving birth to Feanor is so exhausting that she just gives up the ghost.
Oh, yeah, right. That sucks. Oh, so maybe you could argue that Feanor himself, the inception of that child, is the big problem.
Well, yeah. And then you have, given who Feanor is, it's not... I mean, there's a lot there to unpack with given what Feanor gets up to.
Okay.
So okay. Then you have Feanor, who from the start is loaded with bitterness about the passing of his mother and the birth and his father's remarriage. So.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. So Finwë ends up with a second line of sons. He ends up with two more kids or more than that.
But two main ones, right? Fingolfin and Finarfin.
Yeah. He ends up with two more sons, Fingolfin and Finarfin. And there is bitterness between Feanor and the sons of Indus. And all kinds of salt happens here. The first time a sword is ever drawn in Valinor is by Feanor at Fingolfin?
Oh, really? Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, man.
At Fingolfin.
Against his half-brother.
He draws a sword and threatens him, thinking that Fingolfin is trying to usurp his position. He's been listening to the whispers of Melkor. Not directly, but...
Okay.
Melkor has taught him how to make swords and has been whispering rumors about Fingolfin. This is a great example of how the marring of Melkor has been corrupting this hierarchy. It's been disrupting the natural inheritance of this kingship.
Mm.
Feanor should trust that his half-brother will respect that Feanor is the heir to the throne. Not that there would ever need to be an heir, like Finwë is not going anywhere.
Huh.
But
that's interesting.
Yeah, elves don't die.
Yeah, I never thought about that. That's not a good thing. I mean, that like so rules the fate of men, right? And stuff for so long.
Yeah.
And it's not really an issue for elves.
But there you have it, that he is so distrustful of his younger brother. And then his father does die. And Feanor nominally becomes the High King of the Noldor and takes the Noldor out. And we immediately have this rift in the line of kings of the Noldor.
Wow.
Finarfin becomes the King of the Noldor in Valinor. And Feanor takes the line of the kings of Noldor in Middle-earth over the sea.
Interesting.
And we have this whole line becomes muddled because Feanor dies almost right away, thank God.
He does really suck.
He does suck. He sucks so much.
He does.
But then something really weird happens, and that is Maedhros.
His first son,
his eldest son, who should have inherited the line.
Right.
Passes it back to Fingolfin.
Really?
Why?
Because
he is chained to a wall.
Oh.
He's captured by Morgoth and is hung on a cliff for 30 years in torment.
That sucks so much, dude. That sucks.
Yeah. So he's eventually rescued by Fingon, who
Fingolfin's son.
Yeah.
So cousin saving cousin. It's nice.
Yeah. And he basically says, like, it is appropriate to pass the kingship back against the wishes of his brothers, it should be noted.
Right.
And he passes the title of High King of the Noldor to Fingolfin.
Wow. So Fingolfin is with him in Middle-earth then.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So I want to talk about a few things here.
Okay.
So one, Maedhros is considered like an upstanding move.
Yeah.
But it's an improper one.
Why?
Because it's contrary to the way that this should work.
Yeah.
And it's in keeping with the way that the whole line of Feanor is corrupted. he's further muddling the hierarchy there, creating confusion, because now the line, now his brothers will be, it creates an eternal rift between the lines of Feanor and the lines of Fingolfin. They will never recognize the line of Fingolfin as king, not entirely. They set up their own little kingdoms and just kind of pretend Fingolfin doesn't exist. Fingolfin goes up and sets up his kingdoms. But it's contrary to the proper hierarchy. And that's owing to the marring that's caused by the oath.
Yeah, if it were me, like when that first marring happened, it's like, you got to rewrite the rule book, guys. Throw it all out, start again. But I mean, I get it. They are children of habit and hierarchy, right? That's the point you're making.
Yeah, and yeah, the point I'm making here is that they've been marred by that oath, and you can see the evidence of it in the way that it's tampering with the proper way in which they would normally function here. But you do have the line of Fingolfin, which is generally a very good line.
Right.
And so if you look down the line of the line of the High Kings of the Noldor here, mm-hmm. So from Fingolfin, you have Fingolfin, Fingon, Turgon, and then from Turgon, it skips all the way down to Gil-galad. The High Kings of the Noldor are all universally very good and are pretty well respected, with some interesting caveats, which I'm going to talk about here. And I think that's really interesting. That they're all pretty well-respected guys. And even it's interesting that, so that's my first main point about the Kings of the Noldor, is that inheritance kerfuffle.
Yeah, you know what's interesting too, is that when Maedhros, son of Feanor, handed the
handed.
What?
It's funny because Maedhros has his hand chopped off.
That's, you're terrible. Okay. When he bestowed the kingdom back to Fingolfin, now you have two direct brothers, you know, the two sons of Indis. You've got Fingolfin and Finarfin are now sharing one kingship, which is right. And that's kind of weird. I don't know if there's ever any animosity because of that, but that's weird too, right? Even though geographically they were in different spaces. Did it matter was that okay?
It is and it isn't. So that's actually the next thing I'm going to talk about.
Oh,
so,
okay.
One thing that is very, that is very much, I think it's a natural thing for the elves to do. So I think it's okay that the Noldor do it, is the elves fucking love kings. If you look at the Teleri are sort of the control here, because the Teleri are not corrupted in this way. The Teleri set up kings like a motherfucker, and they're not like high kings. They're just little kings.
Aww.
And they prop them up
baby
fucking
kings
everywhere. Everywhere you go, they just split them off and they just set them up everywhere.
Like, so as like, little fiefdoms or something?
Yeah, and they all owe fealty to the higher one.
Mm.
But they, like, you have the elf king from The Hobbit.
Oh, Thranduil?
Yeah, Thranduil, who owes fealty to Thingol back in, you know, in theory. But his kingdom would have owed fealty to Thingol. But you had for example, you have Galadriel, who is functionally a queen in her own realm.
Sure.
But you have this habit of these lines to just sort of fracture off and create their own little realms. And they owe kind of fealty up. They create these hierarchies of like, this is a branching, you know.
Yeah.
They go off and they find, because they want to fill the land and they want to like find their own realms to occupy, but they know who they owe loyalty to, they based on family lines.
Yeah, because nobody ever freaking dies.
Yeah, exactly. Because nobody ever dies.
You can't kind of be like, I'm my own king, because your great grandfather's like now fuck you, I'm still here. Ha ha.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think it's okay that they were both king because they were in different places.
Okay.
And then you, because you do have, like, for example, you have Finrod, for example, who was never the High King, but was a king.
Okay. He was the firstborn of Finarfin, right?
Yeah, firstborn of Finarfin. But he went with them, but he did not stay with Finarfin in Valinor. He followed Fingolfin's kids, with whom he was close friends.
Okay.
Same as the rest of his siblings, over into Middle-earth.
Okay. Oh, sure.
And he founded a realm called Nargothrond.
Oh, yeah, right. I remember that from...
He was the king of Nargothrond.
Sure.
So he was a king, but he was not like a high king. And there were a whole buttload of these sorts of little realms.
It's really confusing, I'm going to tell you. It's very confusing. Sort of reminds me of like the Icelandic sagas and stuff where everybody's doing a thing and going and doing a thing and putting down roots in various places. It's very confusing.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep.
Wow. So that's the line of Finwë.
Mm-hmm.
Marring number one. Yeah. First marring. That's nearly nothing to celebrate. Yep.
So another example I want to bring up is Aeol and Turgon, our friends Aeol and Turgon. So Turgon is generally regarded as a pretty good king. But he didn't lead, he wasn't, there are some caveats there, because one thing he doesn't do is protect his people. He just kind of hides in the city. He isn't like a high king for all of the Noldor, just his own city. And as a consequence, I think it's interesting that he's the one that has his sister refuse to follow his lead, refuse his leadership,
okay,
and flee. He sets these very tight restrictions. He's not the king of all the Noldor. He's the king of just this one city.
Okay.
And as a consequence, his sister flees the city.
Okay. Because she's like, fuck this, I'm not doing this. Why did she flee? Aeol.
And as a consequence, Aeol then comes into the city. And Aeol is an elf who is explicitly described as an elf without a king or a people. He is one who has rejected a king.
Oh.
He owes nominal fealty to Thingol, but has left that realm to set up his own realm and prefers the company of dwarves.
Hmm.
As we've talked about in his original conception, he was a dark elf, like an elf aligned with Morgoth.
Oh, yeah. Are you kind of getting into the story of Thingy, that place that fell? What the heck is it called? Oh, my brain is totally Gondolin. Gone. Gondolin, that's the one.
Yeah.
Why can you and I never remember the name Gondolin? I don't know. Okay.
Yeah. I'm so with when you. He comes back, he has this very dramatic confrontation with the king where he, with Turgon, where he explicitly rejects Turgon's authority over him.
Okay.
He says, take your sister. You may have authority over your sister, but you have none over me and none over my son.
Oh, because Aeol married, is that the one he forced the sister to marry him?
More or less.
Okay, gotcha.
And I think it's interesting to illustrate this because this is a case where the hierarchy breaks down.
Okay.
This is a case where the proper functioning of this of society falls apart. Aeol does not respect the hierarchy of the king, and he attacks the king and kills the king's sister. He attacks his sister and kills his sister, all because of, and I'm not saying that this is necessarily intentional. I just think it's interesting that you have this breakdown of the hierarchy and the proper functioning of this society,
mm-hmm.
all based around this, all because this one character who explicitly rejects kingship is invited in, and you can trace him being invited in back to a king who refuses, who doesn't embrace his responsibility as the king of all.
That, and that's Turgon, you're saying. Turgon's like, whatever, I'm going to make my own city. I'm making Gondolin. Sister's like, fuck you, I don't want to be here, and leaves.
Yeah.
Gets mixed up with this Aerol guy, has a weird kid. They go back to the city, and Errol's like, fuck you, I'm not going to live as your stupid vassal or whatever in your dumb city. Fuck you, Turgon.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just think there's an interesting interplay there where the refusal to be in search of safety.
Okay.
He walls off his city and declines to be the king of all the Noldor and protects only his city. And as a result, this elf that refuses to have any king comes in and causes all this chaos. And his son will then be the undoing of the city.
Interesting.
Why do you think that's really cool?
But why did Turgon not want to be the king of all Noldor anyway? Like, why did he close off the city?
He believed that it was his mission to protect that one city.
Okay.
He had a vision from Olmo of a hidden city, and that was his mission.
I gotcha. All right, cool. Oh, all right. So we have somebody who's not following the hierarchical rules that are set up, doing his own thing, and then that's causing a cascade of other things to happen, and then the city and all the people in it to get majorly hosed.
It's kind of, I mean, it's not 100%, but yeah, that's kind of what I'm suggesting.
All right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. I think it's interesting. So now we're going to sort of do a sort of a side example, or sort of a similar example. We're going to look at the line of men. So Numenor is a really interesting example to look at here, because men are fallen.
Okay.
So in theory, this should not apply to men. However, we have the line of the half-elven.
Okay.
Numenor. Who are an admixture of elves and men.
Sure.
And we have this, they are explicitly said to sort of be touched by the grace of elves. And so they're sort of an interesting example of a line of men for whom the ways of the elves apply. They're raised like elves, especially Elros, the founder of the line of kings of Numenor.
Right. Can I remind everyone, Elros is Elrond's brother, right? And Elrond chooses to go the elven path, and Elros chooses to go the mortal path.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they inherit some of the elven properties. Elros lives to be 500, and it takes thousands of years for that longevity of his line to wear off.
Wow.
So we're going to kind of go through some of these kings and look at the ways in which the Maring slowly sort of corrupts that line.
Cool.
Interesting.
So. That's awesome. All right, cool. Take us through it. Because there are a lot of them, and I, you know, there's a few kind of big ones that you hear about. Like if you read the appendix of Lord of the Rings, you get like a very Cliff Notes version. So it'll be really interesting to hear a little bit more about these guys. And ladies, too. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. So there's 25 kings and queens of Numenor.
Cool.
Over the course of about 3,000 years of Numenor's existence. Elros is the first one. He was half-elven, like his brother Elrond. And unlike his brother, he chose to be mortal, as you said. But that doesn't change what he was, in the sense that he became mortal, but he was still the person he was before he made that choice. He was raised as an elf, and there was still something elf about him. Mm. He lived to be 500. He spoke Quenya and established as a part of his royal lineage, the tradition of taking a Quenya royal name. His was Tar Minyatur, and he established Quenya as the royal language of Numenor.
Cool.
He also had close associations with the elves of Tol Adasea. When he died, his eldest son was already quite elderly. So his eldest son passed on the title immediately to his eldest son,
okay,
Tar Amandil.
Oh, nice.
His only noteworthy accomplishment was the establishing the tradition of passing down the scepter to his son before he died.
Oh.
So he ruled for like 200 years and then passed on the scepter before he was elderly.
Cool.
Like super elderly.
Sure.
That's noteworthy, though, to remember that tradition, though.
Sure, absolutely.
This idea of they ruled while they were in the prime of their life, and then as they started to become elderly, they would pass it on to their the next one.
Sounds kind of familiar, Aragorn.
Yeah. The next one after Tar Amandil was Tar Elendil. Tar Elendil was the first Numenorean king to return to Middle-earth, and he established relations with Gil-galad. He had three children, but at the time, the laws of royal inheritance said that women could not inherit, so his eldest son succeeded him. That was Tar-Meneldur. Tar-Meneldur was obsessed with stars and was super, super into them. And he's remembered most notably for conflict with his son, Tar-Eldarion.
Ooh.
This is about 700 years after Elros, so we're at the fifth king now.
Okay.
Tar-Eldarion, his maternal grandfather was a famous sailor, and he inherited his grandfather's love of the sea. And he was in constant conflict with his father over his sailing, to the degree that his father banned the cutting down of trees to make ships. So he would sail to Middle-earth and make ships in Middle-earth.
Oh, wow.
So his father, he would sneak off to take these like 20-year-long sea voyages. And finally, his father was just like, nah, fuck it. Like, I retire. You deal with this. I'm done. Tar-Eldarion is famous mostly in Middle-earth from a famous lay about his troubled marriage.
Hmm.
His wife was said to believe that the sea was his wife.
Hmm.
He was generally considered to be a good king. He forged strong ties with Middle-earth and built a whole bunch of ports. And he also did away with the rules about women inheriting so that his only daughter could become queen.
That's cool.
His daughter is really interesting. She's the first queen. Her name was Tar Ankalime. She reigned for 205 years, the longest monarch of Numenor after Elros.
Wow, cool.
She's a weird case, though. I would say that she's the first of the Numenorean monarchs to be not great.
Oh, no.
So her mother was bitter about her father's sailing. So she was raised primarily by her mother, rejecting all suitors and hating men.
Sure.
So she took a husband as a political marriage.
Okay.
And didn't allow any of the women who served her to marry, to the degree that her grandchildren were afraid of her and refused to take the throne as a result.
Oh boy. I don't know. If she had been a man, people would have said she's just a strong leader.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
I don't love the whole, like, mother made her bitter towards men.
Yeah. That's stupid
thing. I feel like there's a way to rewrite this character to be much more interesting. And I suspect I don't know for sure, but I bet you there's some really good fan fiction about this character.
Oh, I bet. I hope there is. Ooh, absolutely. We'll have to ask Dawn.
Yeah. So she's pretty interesting. Cool. Her son, Tar Anerian, was the only child of Ankalime. He's completely unknown, except that his eldest two daughters were not allowed to marry by his brother, and that they feared and hated her and refused to take the scepter. As a result, Tar Surian became king after his father. Surian's rule was utterly unexceptional.
sad.
His successor was Tar Telperian, another woman. She was remembered as a proud and willful ruler who refused to wed and was the first ruler of Numenor to die without an heir.
Okay.
She lived during interesting times. It was during her reign that the forging of the rings happened. And the beginning of the War of the Elves against Sauron, but she would have none of it. She withdrew from Middle-earth and was not involved in any of those events.
Okay.
Her son, Tar Minastir, is regarded as the last of the good kings of Numenor. He wanted an alliance with the Elves, but he is also regarded as a weak king, and it was rumored that his son, Tar Kiryatan, forced him to name him as his successor and then spurned an alliance with the elves when he inherited the throne.
Oh, bummer.
Kiryatan built large fleets and sent them to Middle-earth to begin establishing an empire there and oppressing the locals.
Great.
Yeah.
Buddy. Buddy, what are you doing?
Yeah. His son, Tar Atanamir, was a real piece of work. He continued his father's tradition of raiding and establishing bases all over Middle-earth to exact tribute. Atanamir was also the first king to openly speak out against the ban, against Numenor sailing west. To the point where the elves told the Valar about it, and Manwë sent messengers to explain that even if they broke the ban and came to Aman, it wouldn't make them immortal, but he was having none of it.
Oh, buddy.
He was also the first to break the tradition of giving over the scepter to his heir, for which he earned the title the Unwilling. He died, and then his heir took over the kingship after he died.
Interesting.
Something all his successors but one would follow.
Oh, shit.
It's also interesting that following him, all of his heirs would have shorter lives than the predecessor.
Did they die of, like, natural causes, or were they killed? Like,
natural causes, but they would all have shorter lives than the predecessor. Elros lived to be 500, and every king before then had lived between, like, 399, 410, somewhere around there. Tar Ankalimon, who was the son of Tar Antanamir, lived to be 400.
Okay.
And his son, Tar Talamite, lived to be 390.
Okay. Ooh, we're getting shorter. Is this a punishment, or is this just, like, who knows? Or we're just getting farther away in the line?
We're now 10 kings in.
Right.
So we're talking about, let's see, let me see how far in. We're talking about, like, 2,000 years in. We're more than 2/3 of the way through the line, and we have had no degradation in their lifespan until Tar and Kaliman, and all of a sudden we start seeing generation over generation losing. You'll see here how fast it goes.
Whoa, like, man, that guy really fucked it up for everybody.
So the next three kings, Tar Van Imelde, Tar Andukal, and Tar Alkarin. So Tar Ankalamon and Tar Telamakte are just two greedy kings. One really loves Mithril, and the other is noteworthy for being the king during which the Numenor splits into two factions. the faithful and the kingsmen.
Oh.
The faithful are loyal to Aman and the elves. The latter are loyal to Numenor and the king.
Sure.
As I said, they live to be 400 and 390 respectively.
Okay.
Tar Vanimelde, Tar Andukal, Tar Alcarin live to be 360, 371, and 331 respectively.
Whoa, that guy lost like 60 years. Dang.
Vanimelde was the third and last king of Numenor, queen of Numenor. She cared little for ruling and mostly let her husband manage it. She named their son a successor, but when she died, her husband refused and took up the scepter instead. He ruled illegitimately for 20 years before he died, and their son finally took up the scepter.
Oh, gotcha.
The next couple of kings, Tar Calmakal, Tar Ardaman, lived to be 309 and 281.
Uh-oh.
So we're just losing years left and right.
Right.
The first was a warlike king and the first to speak Adunayak as his primary language.
Oh.
The next was the last king to use Quenya at all as his primary language.
Oh, interesting. And that's that tar.
Tar part, yeah.
Yeah, the tar part.
The next king, Adunakor, this guy was a real piece of work. He lived to be 253.
Okay.
His name means Lord of the West,
okay,
which is some real arrogant energy.
Rick, can I just say that in it, Jude wrote real big dick energy in here, and I love it. It makes me laugh.
Yeah. Woo. He banned the speaking of the elvish tongues in his presence and openly persecuted the faithful.
That sucks. All right. Not a cool dude.
The next few kings...
Sorry.
They are... Yeah, the next two kings I just wrote just assholes.
Jude's notes really are wonderful.
For anything other than just continuing to persecute the faithful and establish base, like, and continue to build a big, ugly empire in Middle-earth.
Okay, while their lifespan is shortening. Ar-Zimrathan
and Ar-Zalkathor, Zakalthor, they live to be 235 and 226. Ar-Gimelzor is the next king, referred to as the great enemy of the faithful.
Mm-hmm.
Lived to be 217.
Mm.
He had the bad luck of accidentally marrying one of the faithful because she was very beautiful. And accidentally, and as a result, his heir was Tar Palantir, who tried to repair Numenor, tried to repent, but was sorrowful about the fact, grew sorrowful over the fact that his repentance was not accepted. And there was no response by the elves or the Valar to his repentance. He had a daughter that he named heir, but her rule was immediately usurped by her husband, Ar-Pharazôn. Tar Palantir only lived to be 220.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Ar-Pharazôn, who lived to be 201.
The biggest dick of all. Because
and he's the one that
sailed
west and brought down the ban and sank Numenor.
Right. He was not supposed to go west, and he did.
That was a real quick survey of the queens of Numenor, but you can kind of see the point I'm making here is that things took a real hard turn. Things were going real fine while they followed the hierarchy and while they sort of lived elvish style.
Okay.
And then, right, all of a sudden, they took a turn and they broke out of the hierarchy and they stopped behaving in the elvish way, and it immediately jumped the rails.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, yeah, their life starts shortening. That's like, you know, very damning.
Dramatically.
Yeah, like by hundreds of years. That's so crazy. Can I say two things? The first thing is, excellent job with all these names. That was awesome. I can't pronounce
Thank
any
you.
Of these things, so I'm in awe of your talent. And second of all, to that one guy, I'm trying to look at what you wrote, that he had like a totally, you know, unexceptional ruling. Okay, no news is good news, okay? At least he didn't sail the ships west. So I'm just going to say those guys did fine.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that the kings of Numenor are really interesting, the way that they you have this line of, you know, five, six, seven kings who are just fine, chilling. And then you get to, like I said, you get to like Taron Kalime and things start to get a little bit sketchy. But then you get down to Atmir and then it gets bad.
Freaking Atmir, you know?
And it just, you just bounce. And then as soon as it hits there, things just go, it's all downhill from there.
Can I ask you a question that you're probably not prepared for because it's random, so don't worry if you don't know. But so the second to last king was Tar Palantir. That's the same name as those, like the Lost Seeing Stones, right? The Palantir. Does he have any connection to those or just a coincidence?
It's the word, not the name. He doesn't have a connection to them, but the word Palantir, let me look it up real fast.
Sure.
Here. It means farsighted.
Oh,
and
okay.
The seeing stones. It's the same root as the Palantiri, which means the seeing stones.
Cool. Interesting.
Or far sight stones or something like that.
That was really good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. My purpose of going through those Numenorean kings was to illustrate the way that breaking the hierarchy, the way that the hierarchy of, for the men there, I don't know if he's trying to show that by holding the hierarchy keeps the line of kings from corrupting, or if that corruption enters the line and it drives them from the hierarchy, but it seems pretty clear to me that there is a direct correlation in Numenor between the proper ordering of Numenorean society and the Mari.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I believe you.
So.
I like it.
Yep. We could also talk about the Kings of Numenor if we really felt like it.
You mean Gondor?
But it's basically a smaller scale version of what happens in Numenor. The faithful set up their kingdoms in Arnor and Gondor, and they start out pretty good. And then time passes, and the kings get shitty, and things descend into chaos. It's just a repeat.
Yeah. So. But it's interesting that history repeats itself right over and over again.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And it's like, if you know all that, right? Or if you have some idea that that is like the way that things have gone for thousands and thousands of years, that like really illustrates the importance of Aragorn and how good he is and how and how important it is, like what he did and like what he put back together, you know, the healing of like all of this, like years of crappiness and woe. So I don't know. I think that's pretty cool. It for me, like, because I only know the more high level stuff. It really means a lot to kind of know like what he was up against, you know.
Yeah, and also what he represents. He's the rebirth of these two lines, the line of Gondor and also the line of Numenor.
Yeah.
He's that bloodline.
That's really cool. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well, that's pretty much all I've got. I hope that was interesting. I hope that you, our dear listeners, found it enlightening. I would love to hear your thoughts on it. Hit me up on Twitter or Discord or wherever and let me know if you thought it was interesting, if you have other thoughts, if you agree, if you disagree, if you have other things you want to point out to me. The one thing I didn't bring up in any of this was the whole, like, is Tolkien a monarchist or an anarcho-monarchist or any of that stuff? There's certainly lots of people have lots of thoughts about what Tolkien's personal political views are. I don't find that as interesting. I have always been more interested in looking at Middle Earth as a internally consistent unit, but certainly if you have thoughts on what this topic could mean with regards to Tolkien's personal views, I'm interested. So yeah, let me know.
I have a question for you, Jude.
Sure.
All right. So we've been talking about a lot of elven kings, a lot of Numenorean kings. Like, who is your favorite king to read about and why?
If
it's really hard to choose. I know. So like just one that kind of grabs you a lot.
My favorite key. I mean, I'm always going to say my favorite elf is Finrod.
Sure.
And he's a king. So, but that's kind of cheating because he didn't really do anything interesting as a king. I would say my favorite, see, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how you're, am I answering like which elf is my favorite that also is like under the Wikipedia category of kings of the like elven kings, or am I answering the question of like which elf king bullshit is the most interesting?
Yeah, which elf king bullshit is the most interesting?
Okay, so if you're asking which elf king bullshit is the most interesting, yes. that's easily Thingol.
Okay.
All the other elves, like, they just do, they're kings, and then they do elf stuff, but they don't really do a lot of elf king stuff.
Okay.
Thingol is never not being a dumb elf king. Like, Thranduil does a little bit of it, but, like, he's, like, a shitty clone of Thingol.
Okay.
Thingol is, everything he does is shitty elf king stuff. He's just swinging his big elf king business in everybody's face all the time. The only thing he does that isn't is when he stands in a field and stares at his future wife for a few thousand years. Like, that's the only time he doesn't do a dumb elf king thing.
Oh, that's
and
right.
He still kind of is a dumb elf king because a whole bunch of people stand around looking for him because they want him to be their elf king.
Is Thingol Luthien's dad?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I mean, so he's probably a hottie. Let's just put that out there.
Well, they're all hotties. Oh, they're elves.
Jeez. That's a big problem for me.
But yeah, if you want to read about some dumb elf king stuff, read about Thingol.
Awesome. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. This was a really interesting walk through this. I think that there's probably even more to talk about. So I do hope, you know, people share their opinions like you asked for. And here's my promise to you, dude. I probably won't remember any of these guys' names by the next episode. So yeah. It's a lot. And they all sound similar.
40 elves with names that start with F. Why would that be confusing?
I know. For fuck's sake. Awesome. Well, thank you for this.
No problem. Thank you.
The road may go ever on and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes as it helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at podcast.athrabeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter at @athrabeth_cast. I can be found at Aramidic Jude. Steph can be found at The North Four. Title music is Lord of the Devil Ring by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond5. Thanks for listening.